Welcome back to the margins of Riga Stratcom Dialogue 2022. I am pleased to say that today we're joined by David Agranovich. David is Meta's Director for Global Threat Disruption, where he coordinates the disruption of influence operations, cyber espionage, adversarial networks across the Meta platforms. And prior to joining Facebook, David served as Director for National Intelligence at the National Security Council in the White House. And there he led the U.S. government's efforts to address foreign interference in democratic systems and elections. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe first, I find your background to be quite fascinating, this transition from a national security background to working for a big tech company. Can you tell me about this transition? What surprised you the most, perhaps, in finding out how big tech platforms approach issues that have national security implications? Did you find anything to be shocking?
Great question. It's interesting. I will admit that when I began my career in national security, my goal was to kind of spend my whole career in national security and government. And what had energized me about government work is actually what energizes me about the work I do today. So I got into government because I wanted to, one, understand hard problems, in particular, kind of pull apart the threads of challenging investigations, challenging networks. And two, I wanted to try and be part of engineering the systematic change to address those problems. My government career kind of spanned the early 2010s until about 2018. It was really punctuated by, quite frankly, Russian aggression towards Ukraine in 2014 and the MH17 shoot down that followed, as well as the US elections in 2016 and the foreign interference activity around those elections. During both of those, I was working still for the US, kind of the US government. And then afterwards, I went to the White House. And the reason I went to the White House was the U.S. government at that time wanted to create a strategy for dealing with this kind of foreign interference. We didn't have one. It was kind of a nascent issue for the government as much as it was for the tech companies. Mm-hmm. Spent a year and a half on that. We created a strategy. We were deeply involved in the expulsions of Russian intelligence officers around the Skripal attempted assassination, for example. But what I felt like we were lacking was that kind of cross-societal effort. Now, unbeknownst to me at the time, but companies like Facebook were also just at that time standing up teams designed to look for this type of activity. And not just teams, but like the policies to address it, a strategy of intervention that would meaningfully do something about them. And so when my tenure at the White House came to an end, I had this choice. Do I go back to my agency? Do I continue working on the problem from inside the government? Or go to what was arguably like the true front line of the information war, which was kind of the platform companies at the time trying to get their arms around the problem. And so that's what brought me to Facebook. What surprised me about working on this problem from the private sector perspective first was actually how capable some of these investigative teams can be when they start to understand the problem. When we started the work, you know, it took us a few months at a time to investigate a network, do a takedown. But within about 6 months of starting the work, we were doing, you know, 20-some takedowns in like the second half of our influence operations efforts. Mm-hmm. That was far faster than anything we could do on the government side.
And why is that? Why are big tech companies more agile at this?
I think they're agile in particular ways. I think that governments are very much better suited to addressing this problem through diplomatic levers. They have much better visibility into sophisticated adversaries across the entire ecosystem because they have actual intelligence services. Mm-hmm. But what tech platforms have is a culture of trying to build tools to fill problems. So if we didn't have a tool, if we didn't have kind of the type of information we would need for investigation, we could build something to help us get that. And tech platforms have a different incentive structure, right? Our primary responsibility is protecting the people on our platforms, on our integrity teams, right? Like that's our job, is to make sure the people using Facebook are not being targeted by influence operations, that they're not being hacked by espionage networks.
Well, one could also say one of your incentives is making a profit, of course.
The broader company, of course, yes. I guess what I mean is specifically the teams that are doing this type of integrity and investigations work. And so the balance between do we collect information to understand a network, you know, traditional intelligence work, versus do we use that information to do something is different than government. Mm-hmm. Like governments have classification and they try to maintain access for long times. For us, when we know what a network is doing, the next thing we have to do is take action on it. And so that bias towards action, I think, was one of the reasons you just saw the pace increase so much more quickly.
Thank you so much for this introduction. I think that maybe if we could take a bit of a broader look, you brought up the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014. And I think that in general, you know, in the world we're now facing, in the past few years, we've faced these two major transformative crises with security implications that will face our world for many years to come. Of course, the COVID-19 pandemic and now Russia's brutal, unprovoked war against Ukraine. And I think there is one kind of vicious common denominator for both of those, which is this spread of hostile disinformation, including by malign foreign actors. And in both of those cases, this disinformation has, you know, literally cost lives. It's not something abstract. It's not a theoretical debate. What sort of similarity do you see in the trends in the information space with respect to both of these crises?
So I think one of the common, you know, through lines through both of these is influence operations. They didn't begin with platforms. They evolved with platforms. Thomas Ridd, who, among many other things, wrote a book recently called Active Measures, right, talks about kind of the history of influence operations going back quite a ways, in particular focusing on traditional Soviet influence operations activities. And you can draw a through line from the Soviet influence techniques of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s of trying to get a story picked up by like a low-quality Italian news outlet that would then get picked up by a slightly higher quality wire service that would then get syndicated all over the world, to some of the same tactics that we see these arguably the same threat actors using to try and get a story picked up by a low quality outlet, but that outlet might be an individual or a community online, right? So what it did didn't necessarily fundamentally change the actors. What it fundamentally changed was kind of the venue and the friction that those actors would experience. And so one of the interesting like responses, the interventions to those problems is to one, change the deterrent calculus for the actor, right? Can we make it so that using social media for this activity is less attractive because the costs are higher or because the benefits are lower? And can we increase the friction that they'll experience so that it's a less attractive platform to use? And there's examples in both of these, right? So in the war, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the operations that we have seen from Russia recently, far less effective than some of the Russian operations we saw targeting Ukraine years in the past.
How do you explain this?
Probably a combination of factors. One is certainly that when we identify a network through investigative work, we do two additional things. One is we train our automated detection systems on the takedowns that we do, so they get better at finding those people again. And then we also were building up the expertise within the team looking for this activity, which makes it easier for us to find them. The second thing, though, is likely that we know these adversaries adapt to our enforcement and the enforcement of other tech platforms, the enforcement from law enforcement entities, and it has forced them to adopt techniques that they have to trade off their communication security for reach. And what I mean by that is if you're trying to be really loud, you're an influence operation, your job is to try and reach as many people as possible, you'll also naturally attract attention not just from the people you're trying to talk to, but also from the people who are looking for you. And so we've seen efforts now to try and, for example, rather than running networks on our platform, they'll try and recruit a troll farm in a third party country. There was a takedown that we did of a network in Ghana, for example, mm-hmm. that was running as a proxy of the Internet Research Agency.
And how did this takedown work? Did you need cooperation of the local law enforcement in Ghana? Or what does this takedown practically mean?
This takedown, I actually think this takedown is a great example of the cross-societal partnerships can do against mm-hmm. these networks. So the operation was discovered somewhat independently by our investigative teams, by the investigative teams at some of our partner companies, including Twitter. And a portion of the network was being looked into by an investigative reporter at CNN, Clarissa Ward. And as we were building out our investigation, we were able to link that activity to a particular individual who was a former employee of the Internet Research Agency. And Clarissa and her team... This is Prigozhin's organization.
Famous farm.
Yep. And so we were able to make that link. Originally, it looked like a bunch of folks in Ghana running fake accounts. But these accounts, their behavior was somewhat reminiscent of what the IRA was doing. We were able to then link it to this one person. Clarissa separately reaches out and says, we're doing a story, but we're not really sure what's going on here. We were able to work with them, share some of what we were seeing, and then Clarissa and her team, as she often does, right, she flew to Ghana and actually like door knocked the guy and greeted him in Russian, and it's all on camera. And it was incredibly impactful. One, the troll farm stopped operating almost immediately. Two, it somewhat forced the Ghanaian government to do something about it. So Ghanaian local law enforcement then like raided the troll farm after the story came out. And three, I think it showed platforms are limited in our investigative capabilities. We look at what happens on the platform. by partnering with sharing information with an open source researcher or an investigative reporter, we were able to go from this small narrow window of what Facebook was seeing to the Facebook activity, the Twitter activity, and then actual video of how the troll farm operated across a bunch of platforms.
Do you think Facebook has become effective at cooperating with researchers or kind of open source OSINT analysts? Do you think that enough has been done?
I think we're doing better, but we're not doing enough. Right now, so over the last 4 years, we initially used to share information directly with a few independent research organizations, Stanford's Internet Observatory, the Digital Forensic Research Lab at the Atlantic Council, Graphica, which is a social media research firm. In the last year and a half or so, we've started sharing that information a bit more broadly, using some of our own kind of internal content archiving tools to then share with academic researchers at a number of different institutions. Our team's goal is to expand that further. In keeping with, I think, some of the other platforms that try really hard to share information with researchers, all it does is force multiply, right? If more people are looking for the bad behavior, even if that leads to us getting called out for missing stuff, one, we miss stuff. It's good that people understand that our detection isn't perfect. And two, it means that we're going to catch that stuff more effectively. Mm-hmm. So the short answer is we're doing more. We should be doing more.
I think I can't help but return a bit to Ukraine, of course. This is, of course, the kind of main topic of conversation at this conference and in Latvia, if you walk in the streets. So, you know, Ukraine has been well documented as a sort of a testing ground of sorts for different Russian hybrid warfare instruments, information warfare tools. For instance, several years ago, Russia allegedly used the same cyber instruments that were in attacks on Ukrainian banks and government institutions that were later used in the US in the famous SolarWinds attack. Could you tell me more about how these sort of patterns are replicated and maybe if there are some sort of, again, strategies that you see mirrored from one context to another?
Absolutely. In a few different ways. So taking Ukraine specifically, but I also think it'd be useful to talk about broadly, where do you see kind of new or emerging behavior from, for example, Russian influence activity? So over the last few years, we founded and investigated networks targeting Ukraine a bunch of times. And it was useful to see the type of activity that was occurring there because to some degree, it was similar to activity we would see from those same actors in other countries. Today, I think one area where we see, you know, particularly interesting tactics from influence operators, Russia in particular, is in Africa. And I think something that often gets missed in conversations about influence operations globally is there tends to be kind of this Eurocentric US focus. But when we look at, you know, our team has done more than 150 of these takedowns and reports at this point in 50 countries, 30 languages. The majority of those are in the Global South. Of the operations that we've seen. And so what we see Russian operations, for example, doing in Africa is combining the political focus of, for example, the internet research agency focusing on an election, aligning with, for example, one of Yevgeny Prigozhin's other properties, Wagner Group, which, you know, defends his mining interests in a bunch of these countries. And so you start seeing influence operations that you can't necessarily tell, are they geopolitically focused or are they simply economic? They're also, I think the other thing, the Ghana example is a good one, is this co-opting of authentic communities, of trying to work with communities on the ground, activist communities, sympathetic reporters, marketing firms like the Ghanaian Troll Farm, to launder the connection back to an ultimate actor in another country. The last thing I would note, trends-wise, specific to Ukraine, is so my team also works in cyber espionage activity. Right, essentially hacking of accounts, distribution of malware, attempts to compromise someone's device. And increasingly, we're seeing this convergence of cyber espionage activity, where the actor's primarily trying to hack an account, then using that account for influence activities. An example
so
of this would be Ghost
Rider. Benefits of already having the kind of organic data rather than me now wasting my time creating a fake account and then somehow building up its credibility. Hacking and already having a real user with real, you know, organic background, then that would be a shortcut.
In some ways. And an organic, authentic reputation, right? So what we saw from Ghost Rider, which is we have not attributed Ghost Rider to any particular actor, but there's other groups that have attributed it to alternately Belarusian or Russian hacking groups. But what we saw from Ghost Rider in the run-up to the Russian invasion of Ukraine was Ghost Rider would frequently target primarily European outside of Ukraine targets. But after the war really kicked off, they started targeting Ukrainian targets, journalists, politicians, members of the military. And then after they would gain access to their account, they would start posting videos showing soldiers surrendering or claims that the president had left Ukraine.
Yeah.
Now, the goal there was probably to both use their authentic identity, but particularly their position in the community, right? Mm-hmm. A journalist, a soldier, a government official are trustworthy people. And so that's, I think, why these are so pernicious. They're also pernicious because the compromise themselves often doesn't actually happen on Facebook. What I mean by that is, in the Ghostwriter case, their method of operation is generally compromising email addresses. So they'll, hack your email inbox, then request password resets on all of your social media accounts. If you don't have two-factor authentication, they probably get your social media accounts. And then you're a soldier in the middle of a war. Imagine how difficult it is to get access to your account again.
Yeah, you probably can't be bothered with fixing your password reset while you're in the trenches.
Exactly. And so the difficult decision that platforms then have is, how do you remediate this, right? And so what we ended up having to do was disable a lot of these accounts and then work with partners, in particular the government of Ukraine and activist communities on the ground, to find the people, put us in touch with them, and then help them get their accounts back. But that's incredibly high touch. So the solution is probably something a bit more scaled, like two-factor.
You know, when Russia illegally annexed Crimea and it started its invasion in eastern Ukraine in 2014, Vice, I think, had the famous investigation called Selfie Soldiers.
Yes.
Where Russian troops that, had removed their insignia from uniforms, they were these anonymous little green men, but they were kind of literally posting selfies in armored vehicles and kind of disclosing their troop movements. Reportedly, in this invasion, the Russian kind of troops have been more disciplined, as in the command structures have stripped away soldiers of their smartphones. Is this a dynamic that you have witnessed at all in your research?
Admittedly, the Russian armed forces kind of overt activity hasn't really played a huge factor in the investigations that we've seen. As far as the info ops work goes, it's mostly been either known actors, IRA linked, for example, or Russian government intelligence services, but primarily operating outside of Ukraine. In some cases where we have seen domestic, quote unquote, Ukrainian operations from Donetsk or Luhansk, they appear to be kind of those self-organized militia groups. But it's hard to say. I would imagine that groups like Bellingcat, for example, which I know did a lot of the open source work around the 2014 annexation, would have been reporting on some of the open source signals that are still out there from the current invasion. Admittedly, the current invasion's also, I think, been significantly more overt, right? In 2014, there was this, I remember watching like Simon Ostrovsky's many series of kind of interviewing Russian soldiers. This time around, I think there's been less effort to hide, right? The communication security work has been mostly tactical and less strategic.
One really interesting subject that came up in one of our conversations yesterday that I think your perspective would be really valuable on is that one of the first things that Russian occupying troops do in newly occupied areas of Ukraine, they destroy telecommunications infrastructure. They literally kind of tear down internet towers.
Yeah.
And there's credible research, and this is with the purpose of preventing civilians from documenting and publishing evidence of the atrocities that are being committed. So there's credible research literally suggesting a correlation between access, sort of freedom of internet, and level of atrocities committed.
Yep.
I'm curious, Meta as a company with unlimited resources and power and reach, is there anything Meta can do to ensure help provision of internet, maybe not only in Ukraine, but in conflict zones in areas where the most horrific things should be brought to light?
So one, it's interesting. I talked a bit about like the disruptions work, right? Investigations, disruption of threat actors. A big part of the work around a crisis like this is keeping the platform accessible. And by the platform, I don't just mean Facebook. I also really mean WhatsApp. In no small part because WhatsApp is an end-to-end encrypted secure communication option for people that's generally low friction. And so there has one of our big efforts here has been doing what we can. I mean, it is difficult when the physical infrastructure is just gone, but doing what we can to ensure that even in areas where things might be throttled, we're trying to give people access to their communication capabilities. And in particular, where the infrastructure may eventually be replaced by less secure infrastructure, let's say, that end-to-end communication options are available to people so that they can still talk about these things without necessarily having to worry about being intercepted.
In a kind of concluding segment, maybe a bit less geopolitics, but sure. I can't let you off completely easy. You know, sure. Of course, Meta, among other big tech platforms. To put it simply, I think a lot of people are mad at you, right? You have attracted a lot of public criticism. And I think especially in the last few years, we've had some high profile cases of whistleblowers, Christopher Wiley, Francis Haugen, among them, shedding light into malpractice or unethical behavior by such platforms. What lessons have you garnered from this? How do you see the path forward to rebuilding trust, rebuilding public trust, coming out of this crisis of trust?
So I do think that large platforms, I mean, powerful organizations deserve to be held accountable, right? And so the fact that people are asking these questions is important. And I think you've seen, whether it's questions from regulators in the EU, questions from people in the US, the civil society, questions around the platform, these are, it's important to ask these questions because it helps us improve. How do we get there? It's interesting. So maybe to like up-level it just a bit, All of the disruptions work that we do has a couple of key tenets, right? There's the investigations themselves, there's the takedowns of the whole networks kind of timed in a way to maximize the cost on the adversary. But there's a third really important piece, which is transparency around our activities. At the end of the day, in particular, because people question what we're doing, why we're doing it, the only way that we can rebuild trust is by being transparent about what we're doing, why we're doing it, and what we're seeing on the platform. And giving people the ability to see more than just kind of a superficial analysis. One, we've actually seen that reporting be useful from a deterrence perspective, because it turns out clandestine operators don't like being exposed publicly. But two, it is really important that if someone says, have you seen coordinated inauthentic behavior in country X, we can essentially point to this report and say, look, this is a report about what we've seen. So if it's there, it's there. That, I think, is the way we get there. And you asked this question about researcher community collaboration. I think that's another important key pillar here. OSINT researchers both find really bad stuff, but they can also hold platforms accountable for what we are seeing, how we're interpreting it, what we're missing. But that only comes if we can find ways to share information with researchers in privacy-conscious ways, but in ways that actually are useful for them.
And maybe one final question. So you work on removing adversarial networks, on illegal content, some harmful content. But, you know, there is research suggesting that in some ways, these big tech platforms, they benefit from having some of this really polarizing, maybe even radicalizing content simply because of your algorithms are structured in this way. And, you know, people have a natural instinct to look to, you know, to gravitate toward the sort of polarizing discussion, not even necessarily because they agree with it, but kind of just to see how horrible that other side is. You know, I think I'm sometimes guilty of this. I'm sometimes guilty of looking at going on these messaging boards and Facebook groups at with, you know, kind of radical organizations or organizations that I don't agree with. But so they're the company's, you know, algorithmic and kind of profit structure does benefit from this in some way. How do you kind of square the circle here?
So I'll caveat what I'm about to say by saying two things. One, that the work that my team does is generally not content driven. And quite frankly, most of what we take down is not illegal in most of the countries in which we're doing the enforcement. This is actually a place where regulation would be really great, right? Oftentimes the type of stuff we're seeing political campaigns do or a politician hiring a marketing firm doesn't violate any laws in the countries in which they're doing it. And so when we're doing these actions, we are often well outside of what like the established societal norm in that country might be. So welcome that. What I mean by not necessarily content focused is oftentimes the networks that we're looking at are identified by either deceptive behaviors that they're engaged in or technical links to like previously discovered bad activity. And so we generally don't even end up reviewing content. Like the content that they post is almost immaterial. Some of the IRA operations, the Ghanaian troll farm actually is a good example, didn't actually post political content for the vast majority of its existence.
What did they post?
Basically the type of stuff that people are likely to follow them for. And by that, I mean like pictures of puppies, pictures of kittens, kind of reused memes from other popular sites. The challenge, I think, in the info ops space is we've tried, a lot of people I think have tried, content-first approaches. We're like, all right, this is IRA content, so we're going to find all the IRA content. And what you end up finding is especially now where the IRA reuses content generally, what you generally find is a lot of innocent people or authentic people or maybe even the originator of the content, and the bad actor is somewhere in the mix. When you do a behavioral first approach, you don't have to worry about this false positive as much because they're not going to be showing that signal of deceptiveness. The last thing I did want to address more directly is I believe, and I think this is borne out in the type of work our teams have done, that a platform that people feel safe using and feel safe in the community and don't, you know, can trust in the people that they're talking to being authentic people and not fake accounts is vital to the health of that platform, right? And so I take a bit of issue with the underlying argument that, you know, divisive, hateful, anger-inducing content drives the overall business model, only because in the long run, it's just not good for the platform. And I would argue even our own research has shown that. Short term, people like to go seek out things they don't like. Longer term, they tend to leave because it's all stuff they don't like. And so I do think, and this is the argument I'd make for like, why do we do this work in the first place? We have to keep our users safe, but there is an existential business argument around why we need to keep the platform safe as well.
Well, thank you so much for finding the time to join us. You have a lot of work ahead. Best of luck with it.
Thank you. And thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.